Science is the great antidote to the poison of enthusiasm and superstition. Hi, I'm Juliette Selgren, and this is my podcast, The Great Antidote, named for Adam Smith, brought to you by Liberty Fund. To learn more, visit www.adamsmithworks.org. Welcome back. The summer of 2022 will see a historic moment for the Supreme Court when Ketanji Brown Jackson will replace retiring Justice Stephen Breyer, as the first Black woman to become a justice of the United States Supreme Court. Today, on May 27th, 2022, I'm excited to be talking to Clark Neely about this and to invite him back to the podcast. If you haven't listened to our first interview, it's called Clark Neely on Police Abuse and What to Do About It, which we recorded in 2020. He is the Senior Vice President for Legal Studies at the Cato Institute, and he knows a lot of things. Welcome back to the podcast.
Great to be with you.
So before we jump in, what is the most important thing that people my age or in my generation should know that we don't?
You know, I'm thinking about this question, and it's always a little presumptuous to assume what people do or don't know and then to tell them what they should know. But with that being said, I think that an important thing for people to understand is that you're really not entitled to your opinion on everything. There are some things that are just factually a certain way. And I think there are even things that are just morally a certain way. And if you take a different position, then you are wrong. And that doesn't mean you're not entitled to some opinions. You're certainly entitled to an opinion about, you know, whether Mexican food is better than Indian food or which one you prefer to eat, or maybe you like them both. But there are other things that it's really not reasonable to just have an opinion about, because there is a true fact about that thing. And I think it's really important to distinguish between those and to not insist on having your own personal point of view about something that there is an objective truth about. So that's what I would say.
Good response. Something to keep in mind. So let's jump in. In a blog over at the Cato Institute called Confirm Judge Jackson, you highlighted what you consider to be Ketanji Brown Jackson's most important qualification for the Supreme Court. And you wrote, quote, "She would be the first justice who worked as a public defender, and unlike most of the other justices, she never served as a prosecutor or other courtroom advocate for the government," end quote. Can you tell us a little bit about her and why that qualification is so important?
You bet. So as you said, Judge Jackson, and hopefully soon to be Justice Jackson, is rather unique in that she is the only, would be the only justice on the Supreme Court who's ever worked as a public defender. Now, she worked as an appellate public defender, so she wasn't really down there sort of in the trenches in the courtroom, but it's still, I think what's less important is the specific nature of that experience versus the kind of the orientation and what it tells you about somebody who sought out that kind of work instead of being on the other side of being a prosecutor. And only one other justice in living memory has had any real experience doing criminal defense work, and that was Justice Thurgood Marshall. He was not a public defender, but he did a fair amount of criminal defense work. And the reason why that is so important, it's you have to appreciate the context here. And the context is that the federal judiciary that consists of between 700 and 800 lifetime appointed judges is wildly imbalanced in favor of former prosecutors and other former courtroom advocates for government. In other words, people whose job it was to go into court and present the government's perspective on an issue, to argue for government power and government prerogatives. Again, our federal judiciary, emphatically including the U.S. Supreme Court, is wildly disproportionately made up of people who did that work at some point in their career. Very few lawyers, statistically speaking, have ever been a courtroom advocate for government, but a huge percentage of sitting federal judges and Supreme Court justices have done that work. And so I think to have an institution that is so imbalanced towards people who've chosen a particular career path that involves advocating for the power and prerogatives of government, I think it's a terrible mistake to allow an institution like the federal judiciary, where probably the most important thing they do is adjudicate disputes between government trying to assert power and individuals, trying to push back against that power. And who gets to decide those disputes? An institution that is wildly disproportionately composed of people who used to represent the government in court. And Ketanji Brown Jackson represents a fresh approach and a pushback against this decades-long trend.
Why does this imbalance exist?
You know, it's a hard question. I think that the imbalance exists probably in large measure because of the way that we appoint federal judges in this country. It's a very prestigious position to be a federal judge. It's also a political position in the sense that the process for being nominated and confirmed as a federal judge is inherently political. You have to come to the attention of a senator from the state where you live, or someone in the White House who thinks that you would be a good person to have on the federal courts. And, you know, it's not just a matter of qualifications. There's political considerations that come into it. Maybe the senator has a friend who wants to be a judge and you need a favor from that senator. Of course, it's never that explicit, but that's very much a part of the process. And in order to make it through the confirmation process, think about who you're having to satisfy that you would be a good judge. You have to satisfy a bunch of people who decided to be senators. And what do they spend most of their time doing? Well, besides raising money to get reelected, the other thing they spend their time doing is making policy, at least in theory. And do you really think they want somebody on the court who's going to be oriented in the direction of taking a really hard look at the constitutionality of the policy that they make in the Senate? Do you really think they want somebody who's going to be aggressive about, you know, sort of grading their constitutional homework and saying, you know, that law you guys just passed is not constitutional? I'm skeptical whether the average senator really wants a judiciary full of judges who are aggressively skeptical about the, you know, constitutional legitimacy of what comes out of Congress. And so I think that for a number of reasons, there's just a tendency to sort of orient in the direction of people who have worked in the government, who sort of demonstrated their allegiance for Team Red or Team Blue, and who seem dependable. In sort of going to bat for whatever the exercise of power or prerogatives Team Red or Team Blue, you know, whichever team happens to be in power at the time, wants to do. And in my book, Terms of Engagement, I compared it to, imagine if, you've got a little kid who gets to interview babysitters and pick one, you know, and you can imagine the kid saying, well, you know, I prefer babysitters who aren't too strict when it comes to the enforcement of household rules, like how many desserts I get to eat or what time I go to bed or how much time TV I get to watch. I think, you know, it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, but maybe it's not so inaccurate. You know, maybe it's a fair analogy.
I want to use this moment and that point to address something that many people believe about the Supreme Court and about who's appointed and how they're going to rule in a lot of cases. And so first, can we trust Democrat appointees and Republican appointees to be fair instead of voting against party lines? But also, I mean, historically, we've seen that they don't, like, a lot of the times people on different sides of the aisle vote similarly in the end. So can you kind of unpack that and break down the myth that I think a lot of people believe about parties being super significant to how you will rule in a case?
Right. So I think there's kind of two things going on here. One is whether a particular judge's, you know, sort of political ideology or political affiliation is a kind of reliable predictor of how they will rule in a given case. So that's point one. I think point two is, whether it's reasonable for members of one party, Democrat or Republican, to resist the nomination of a judge by a president of the opposing party simply because they disagree with that judge's ideology. And if we take the first point, whether a judge's, you know, political affiliation or orientation is a reliable predictor of how they will rule in a given case, I think the answer is usually no. Most of the cases that come before the courts are not politically charged. They don't have a really strong ideological valence. They tend to be much more sort of garden variety disputes where the proper outcome is not seriously in doubt. And you could, you know, if you had the ability to you know, run an experiment where you had the same case go before a panel of, you know, mainly Republican-appointed judges versus, and then run it again in front of a panel of mainly Democratic-appointed judges, you'd get the same result both times because there's a pretty clear answer. At the margin, though, there certainly are some cases where a judge's, you know, kind of ideological orientation could well influence, if not determine, the outcome of the case. You know, I would say one issue that's pending in front of the Supreme Court this term is the Second Amendment and gun rights. I think there's a strong correlation between a judge's or justice's political affiliation or ideological affiliation and how they're likely to come down in a Second Amendment case. In other words, whether they're likely to embrace or reject the idea that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to own the guns. So the answer is yes, in some cases, sort of political affiliation can almost certainly be outcome determinative, but that's a small fraction of the cases that come before judges. And in most cases that the courts hear, you'll get the same answer whether you're in front of a, you know, sort of a blue panel or a red one. I don't know if you want to talk about the second point or not. I may have read into your question something you didn't ask, but I do think that there's, you know, the inclination of senators to confirm or resist a nominee, you know, by a president of the opposing party. That's definitely become a thing.
Yeah. I mean, I would say we could explore it, but I want to get back to Jackson. And also, the way that I see that is their job is politics. And so it makes sense that they follow political lines. And I also think their job is not to be experts on how justices make decisions. And so it seems to me that they kind of misunderstand, but also use it as a political move. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, look, we'll go wherever you want to go with it. I think the most significant thing, I think, is that there's been a shift probably in the last 40 or 50 years from the Senate essentially saying, look, our job is just to determine if this person is minimally qualified and not corrupt. But and that's how it was, I think, for most of our history. But starting 40 or 50 years ago, it really became a kind of a political football like what you've described. So I'm happy not to get into that, but if it's worth getting into, I'm happy to do it. So you take us where you want to go.
I think this sort of thing deserves an interview of its own, so maybe another time. But back to Jackson, what are the kinds of cases where her specific experience will make a difference compared to other justices where their experience was as a prosecutor?
Right. Well, we can't know for sure, what specific cases Justice Jackson's, you know, prior professional experience as a public defender might influence, you know, her perspective and perhaps even the outcome. But it seems, you know, reasonable to suppose that she will be somewhat more sympathetic to arguments from criminal defendants than judges whose background was as a prosecutor. That's not certain by any means, but there are really a tremendous number of legal rules, or what we call doctrines, that are, I would say, kind of breathtakingly government favored in the criminal justice space and elsewhere. And I would think that a judge who you know, a person who kind of went out of their way to do work that involved, you know, mitigating against the government, like I did as a public interest lawyer, I've spent most of my professional career as a public interest lawyer resisting the government, litigating against the government. And, you know, look, that has certainly affected my worldview. It certainly affects how I look at certain issues. And I think the same is likely to be at least somewhat true of Judge Jackson. And I think, again, you know, in criminal cases, she's probably going to be more skeptical of arguments from law enforcement, police, prosecutors, et cetera, than her colleagues might be.
And not everyone seems to agree in thinking that this is a benefit. In fact, your colleague Trevor Burrus, who's a regular on this podcast, reported that Senator Tom Cotton mocked Jackson by saying that she would have gone to the Nuremberg trials not to prosecute the Nazis, but to defend them. And Senator Ted Cruz claims that public defendants choose their line of work, quote, because their heart is with the criminal defendants. Their heart is with the murderers, the criminals, and that's who they're rooting for, end quote. What would you respond to these comments?
Oh, it's just raving nonsense. I mean, you know, it's the kind of thing, I suppose you could train a parrot to say this, or, you know, if somebody was, having a seizure and they were just sort of raving incoherent gibberish, that's all it is. I mean, they're throwing red meat to their constituents. I would be surprised if either of them even believe any of the things that they said that you just quoted. It's, you know, I know both Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton, and I disagree with them on a number of issues, but it's easy to caricature them, and I really do strongly disagree with them and would not wish to see either of them be president of the United States. But, you know, I know that they're both smarter than that, because that's just stupid nonsense.
And so I know that you wrote a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee defending and making the case for the confirmation of Judge Jackson. And you said, so you were talking about Guantanamo Bay, and there's this quote I have, quote, those who question Judge Jackson's commitment to law and order by virtue of her advocacy on behalf of detainees at Guantanamo while in private practice, in parentheses, including an amicus brief she prepared for the Cato Institute and others in 2009, end parentheses, may wish to consider whether they really mean to convey to the brightest legal minds of the next generation that if you represent clients in connection with the, quote, wrong cause, whether that be detainees in the war on terror, gun owners exercising their Second Amendment rights, parents seeking educational options for their children, or protesters at a political rally, you can forget about ever becoming a Supreme Court justice, end quote. So I want to get into the amicus brief, but first, can you expand on the issue or the problems that arise from these criticisms?
Yeah. The most basic point is this. We have an adversarial legal system. Not every country does, but ours is adversarial. What that means is that the way we arrive at a verdict, the way we try to get to the correct legal result when there's a dispute between two parties, whether it's the government and a citizen or two individuals, whatever it might be, is that they square off in this adjudicative proceeding. We refer to the process as litigation. And the essence of that process is that each side seeks to put forward its strongest arguments and explain to the adjudicator why the arguments of the other side are not persuasive. And the key actors in this litigation process in our society are lawyers. Lawyers are trained, at least in theory, although you don't really get this much training in law school, but at least on the job, you know, trained to understand the rules of procedure that apply, because there are only certain ways you can present your arguments and your evidence. In theory, again, trained to present arguments in sort of the most persuasive way possible. And the job of, of advocating for your client is, you know, a deeply important one, because our system won't work if adjudicators do not have the opportunity to hear the strongest argument from each side. So now imagine a world in which, you know, people who think they might want to be on the Supreme Court, or even just a judge one day, refuse to take on cases like the, you know, the challenges over detaining people at Guantanamo Bay indefinitely, which is what we're coming up on now, that's going to undermine the credibility, the efficacy, and the accuracy of that adjudicative process, because the judges who have to decide those cases will not be getting the best arguments on both sides, because, you know, people with the credentials, the ambition, the desire to be a judge one day will just say, well, you know what, I'm not going to ruin my chances of becoming a judge by participating in this kind of litigation. And then, well, who are you going to get? Well, maybe there are still really good people who will be involved, but on balance, you're going to be removing from that environment some very bright people whose advocacy would have helped produce a better decision. And, you know, once this kind of thinking, the kind of thinking that you know, is expressed in those Cotton and Cruz quotes that you gave earlier, once that spreads, there's no stopping it, right? Now, any kind of controversial issue, potentially you'll have people saying, well, you know, I'm just not going to get involved. I'm not going to participate as a lawyer in that case because I just don't want to be, I don't want to carry that taint with me for the rest of my career. And I don't want it to ruin my chances of becoming a judge. And at that point, the entire system, you know, ceases to work properly. If you can't get really smart, capable advocates to take one side in a high profile or controversial case. And I think it's an incredibly irresponsible thing to say in the context of this nomination, and deeply regrettable.
Okay, so before we get into the context, or the content of the brief that she prepared for Cato, can you explain to us what an amicus brief is, what that process is? How can she prepare it on behalf of someone else or for some, like, can you explain that?
Yeah, so an amicus brief is, it's the technical term is amicus curiae, simply Latin for friend of the court. The idea is that, you know, a person or an organization that is not a party to a case may nevertheless have something interesting to say or helpful that the would enable the court to come to a better decision. Maybe they have some facts that they can supply because they've got access to some empirical information, or, you know, sometimes you'll get a brief that's filed on behalf of a bunch of historians who, you know, have a deep understanding of a particular era in our history that may be relevant to the case. And so they'll get together and they'll submit this friend of the court brief that is not, again, it's not submitted on behalf of an actual party to the case. But it's submitted on behalf of an organization or an individual who wants to share a particular perspective with the court. And what you'll find is that in, you know, particularly in high-profile cases, you know, like the Dobbs abortion case that's pending in front of the Supreme Court right now, or the New York State rifle and pistol case that's pending on the Second Amendment, you can get dozens or even hundreds of amicus briefs that seek to share a wide variety of perspectives with the court in the hopes that one of the justices or one or more of the justices will pick up on some argument that's in an amicus brief. And it does happen from time to time. You'll see amicus briefs cited in Supreme Court opinions from time to time. And so it seems that they at least potentially can, help to influence the justices' analysis and conclusions in a given case.
So then what was the case that she prepared on behalf of Cato?
Well, there was a great deal of litigation in the wake of 9/11 over this policy that we adopted of rendering, which is kind of a fancy term for sometimes kind of kidnapping or otherwise acquiring the physical custody of a person that we may suspect of terrorist activity, and bringing them to the naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, the U.S. naval base there. And that was done because the status of that place in the world is somewhat unclear. The legal status of the people who are held at Guantanamo Bay, they're not within the formal, you know, territory of the United States, but neither are they in a foreign country. It's in this kind of gray zone. And the government did that very clearly to make it, to limit the scope of the, you know, the kind of the rights that people would be able to assert if they, for example, you know, wanted to be able to make an argument that there was a case of mistaken identity. I'm not the guy you think I am. I'm just a taxi driver from Karachi with no connection to any stuff. The government wanted to limit the ability of detainees to have kind of the sort of full access they would have to courts and the full panoply, you know, constitutional protections that would otherwise apply. So that's the essence of what was going on there. And the brief that Judge Jackson and her team, she was then an associate at a big law firm, but the brief that they put together was about a particular, you know, arrest of a particular individual under circumstances that person claimed were unlawful as part of the global war on terror.
And this might be a weird question. Does it change your letter to them? Does it give you more of a qualification to speak on her qualifications that you have worked with her in this way? Or does that introduce kind of question at all?
I would say neither one. To be honest, I never met her. This brief was prepared before I joined Cato. I joined Cato about 5 years ago, and this brief was submitted well before then. And so I didn't meet her. I don't even know how much interaction the folks at Cato had with Judge Jackson. You don't always have a lot of interaction with lawyers who are drafting an amicus brief. And Cato was really one of several organizations that joined that brief, so it wasn't even like the brief was sort of tailored for Cato specifically. And so I just don't think it really cuts either way. I think that I don't have any personal connection to Judge Jackson. I think it was kind of interesting and serendipitous in some ways that she had participated in drafting an amicus brief that Cato joined. But that's not a huge, you know, connection. I certainly don't think it anyway sort of undercuts my assessment of her qualifications for the Supreme Court, or you know, evidences any sort of subjectivity on my part or anybody else at Cato.
And when you say joined, that means that Cato supported that file, that specific brief.
Yeah, the way I read this brief is that sometimes you know, you'll submit a brief that's written by Cato, and Cato is filing that amicus brief on its own behalf, saying this is the view of the Cato Institute, these are the arguments that Cato wants the court to consider. Other times, there will be a joint amicus brief where you'll have multiple organizations will join the same brief, and they'll essentially say, well, you know, we are separate organizations, but we all agree and support the arguments being presented in this amicus brief. And I can give you an example of that. You may recall we talked about qualified immunity before, which is a legal doctrine that the Supreme Court invented out of whole cloth to make it more difficult to sue police and other government officials. Cato, as part of its campaign to eliminate qualified immunity, came up with what we call the cross-ideological amicus brief. And we went out and recruited the most ideologically diverse range of groups ever to join the same amicus brief in the Supreme Court. It went all the way from the ACLU and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund at one end of the spectrum to Alliance Defending Freedom and the Institute for Justice, Reason Magazine, and others. So it was a truly cross-ideological brief, and the message was, in essence, look, these groups really don't agree on anything, but they do agree that this qualified immunity doctrine is illegitimate and needs to be eliminated. So that's, you know, how briefs shake out. That was certainly an attempt to convey to the court just how wrong it was when the Supreme Court is you know, defending this legal doctrine that it invented called qualified immunity in the face of a virtually complete resistance from the legal public interest community, whether left, right, or center, is a powerful message, I think, to send to the Supreme Court. Other times, you know, the groups join in a brief, as in the brief that Justice Jackson wrote for us. You know, those were all politically aligned or ideologically aligned groups, so we weren't conveying the same message that, you know, like everybody disagrees with this. So anyway, there's no sort of template. Each amicus brief can be different, and sometimes they make different points, and sometimes they're joined by one or multiple entities.
That's so cool. We briefly learned for like 2 minutes about amicus briefs in high school. And so I just like, thank you. Okay. Back to Jackson again. In a piece for the Wall Street Journal, Georgetown Law Professor Randy Barnett, who's been a guest on this podcast as well, noted that, quote, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson may not be an originalist, but she sounded like one in her confirmation hearings this week, end quote. And he was referring to when she said, quote, I believe that the Constitution is fixed in its meaning, dot, dot, dot. I believe that it's appropriate to look at the original intent, original public meaning of the words when one is trying to assess, because again, that's the limitation on my authority to import my own policy, end quote. What is the significance of this quote of hers?
Well, that's a great question. And I think that reasonable people could differ. I'll tell you what I think. One of the things that's important to keep in mind is that almost nothing about a judicial confirmation hearing is spontaneous. You would not believe the amount of work that goes into preparation. A nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court has been through so many moots, and a moot is just, you know, sort of practice session where, you know, White House staffers will literally pretend to be particular senators, and they will read up and try to think of the kinds of questions that that senator might ask. And a Supreme Court nominee has been through so many of those that I'm not saying that it's inconceivable that they would ever say something sort of truly impromptu, but not very much. So you can pretty safely assume that anything they say during their nomination hearing has not only been kind of rehearsed in a sense, but, you know, sort of discussed, critiqued, strategized, and gained out. Now, does that necessarily mean that it's entirely, you know, sort of instrumental, that it's insincere in some way? No, it doesn't. And it would be, I think, a tremendous misjudgment for a nominee to come out and say things that they just palpably didn't believe. But there's a lot of room to, you know, sort of polish an answer in a way that will sound congenial, or one belief will sound congenial to the senators whose confirmation votes you need in order to be confirmed to the court. And my gut tells me that there was probably more than a little bit of practice in that response. And, you know, whether it perfectly expresses her sort of deepest beliefs about the Constitution and about the proper method for judges to interpret and apply the Constitution, I wouldn't presume to say. But one thing I can pretty well assure you is that that answer was not spontaneous. And I would guess that a great deal of thought and discussion went into what would be the best way to answer that question long before she ever sat down in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
So that means it's not necessarily she's not an originalist, but she might not be. Then what would you say is her judicial philosophy?
I really don't know. I don't think anybody can know what Ketanji Brown Jackson's judicial philosophy is. You know, she spent the bulk of her judicial career as a federal district court judge, and that's the trial court level of the federal judiciary. And, you know, what district court judges do is when it comes to sort of legal reasoning, they're doing their best to understand what the law in the circuit where they work. So the country is broken up into 12 geographical circuits, and the District of Columbia is one of those. So as a district court judge in the District of Columbia, Judge Jackson would have been looking to precedents from the D.C. Circuit and potentially also the Supreme Court, but mostly to the D.C. Circuit, and simply trying to apply those faithfully to the facts of a given case. There is really not very much room for district court judges to sort of, you know, reveal to the world their personal judicial philosophy, because it's really not relevant to the job. They're supposed to apply existing precedent to the cases that come before them, not to make it up themselves. Now, once in a while, there'll be, you know, an issue of first impression, meaning there's just no applicable case law, and then they have to, you know, kind of decide what they think is the you know, most appropriate legal outcome. And there's a couple times when Judge Jackson had to do that as a district court judge, but those are just tiny little snapshots. And so And she was only on the D.C. Circuit, which is the Court of Appeals that is above the D.C. District Court, for a period of a few months before she was nominated to the Supreme Court. So we really have not had an opportunity to see what her judicial philosophy is. Now, I'll quickly add to that something that just we haven't really talked about yet, but I was absolutely thrilled to see. As an undergraduate at Harvard, she actually wrote her senior thesis on a legal issue that is my number one focus professionally these days. I think one of the most important things in the entire criminal justice system, which is coercive plea bargaining. And by that, I mean the process that occurs in nearly every criminal prosecution in America today, whereby prosecutors will seek to apply as much pressure as they can to persuade a defendant to waive their constitutional right to a trial and instead simply plead guilty and spare the government the trouble and expense of actually proving their charges in open court, because they have managed to pressure the defendant into waiving that right to a trial and simply saying, yep, you got me, I'm guilty, and I'm not going to fight it. So her senior thesis at Harvard was all about this issue, of course, of plea bargaining. I think she did an absolutely brilliant analysis of that very important subject. What that tells us about her judicial philosophy, I couldn't say, but I'm thrilled that she thought it was important enough, to write a senior thesis about.
And I think this is an issue deserving of its own interview, as many things related to this entire interview are. But from what I'm vaguely aware of that issue. And so one way that's done is through like super, super high bailout fees, right?
Yeah, there are just an astonishing number of levers that prosecutors can apply to induce somebody to plead guilty. And certainly one of those is ensuring that the person is locked up while they are awaiting trial. There's actually empirical evidence that shows that someone is significantly more likely to plead guilty if they have been denied bail and are therefore locked up while they're awaiting trial, versus if you're able to make bail and you're out in the world, then you are less likely to plead guilty. And so having people locked up pre-trial is very attractive to prosecutors, because really these days their primary job is not really proving somebody is guilty. Their primary job these days is inducing people to plead guilty. That's the bread and butter of what prosecutors do in this country nowadays. Contrary to what most people think, they're really not advocates that much anymore. Their main function is to exert enough pressure to get people to plead guilty. That's basically the job of a prosecutor these days.
And I wish we had more time to get into it, but this seems to be an issue for another interview. Thank you so much for your time and for your wisdom. I have one last question for you. What is one thing that you believed at one time in your life that you later changed your position on, and why?
Well, I hope this doesn't sound too self-serving, but when I was an undergrad, I thought the last place I would ever go was law school. I had a very negative impression of lawyers. I sort of viewed them as, just nothing but hired guns, with no real principles, no integrity, and, just sort of there to try to win the case for whoever happens to be paying them. I think that was, there's maybe a kernel of truth to that in some settings, but I think on balance, that was a somewhat glib and perhaps even immature way to view the legal system. I've since, and again, maybe it's self-serving because I've been a lawyer for 25 years, but I've since come to have a much different impression, both of the legal system and of lawyers' role in the legal system. The bottom line is this: there will always be disputes in any given society. Anytime you have a bunch of people, living in close proximity, interacting with each other, they're going to get in disputes. They can be commercial disputes. They can be disputes over, between two neighbors over a fence, whatever it might be, and disputes between the government and citizens. Those disputes have to be resolved some way, and it's extraordinarily important that they be resolved peacefully, if at all possible, because often in throughout history, they're not resolved peacefully, and everybody loses when that happens. So I don't know if we have the best system for resolving disputes in the world, but I think we do have one of the best systems that's ever been devised. And I think lawyers play a really important role in ensuring that system produces just results and in a peaceful manner. And I'm not saying that all lawyers are, you know, wonderful people who we should admire by any stretch, but I am saying that the system itself really is designed to try to produce just results in a peaceful manner. And I think that's really important. I didn't appreciate that when I was younger.
Once again, I'd like to thank my guest for their time and insight, and I'd like to thank you for listening to the Great Antidote podcast. The Great Antidote is sound engineered by Rich Goyette. If you have any questions, any guests, or topic recommendations, please feel free to reach out to me at thegreatantidote@gmail.com. Thank you.